From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the mystery of D.B. Cooper. Probably don't have to set that up too much, but here goes. In the fall of 1971, a man hijacked a commercial flight from Portland to Seattle, demanded $200,000 in small bills, which he got, then bailed out of the aircraft and has not been seen again. D.B. Cooper has become a myth, a famous outlaw. There have been songs and poems written about him. There have been hundreds of tips and suspects. Our guest today is a journalist, Jeffrey Gray, who was drawn into the story and has had a hard time letting it go. It's a common theme, by the way. Gray will talk to us about the theories, the characters, the evidence, and will explain why the hunt for D.B. Cooper is an odyssey that tests the boundaries of obsession. Join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Years now, people have been obsessing about D.B. Cooper. That's the name, of course, given to the mysterious man who hijacked a commercial flight from Portland to Seattle in the fall of 1971. Turns out there were a lot of people at the time who were hijacking planes, but only one got away with it, or may have anyway. The passenger, who called himself Dan Cooper, said he had a bomb and demanded $200,000. He got the money, strapped himself into a parachute, and he jumped into the dense forest of the Pacific Northwest. The journalist Jeffrey Gray isn't the first to become captivated by the story and determined to solve the mystery, which is a pretty daunting task at this point. There are hundreds of suspects and persons of interest. There are letters and photos and interviews and tips and theories. The FBI file on the case is said to run more than 40 feet long. Jeffrey Gray has compared the hunt for D.B. Cooper to the quest to find the Holy Grail. In the book he's written, he calls the hunt an odyssey, one that tests the boundaries of obsession— and one that the further you get, the stranger it becomes. Today in the program, Jeffrey Gray is joining us to talk about his book. It's called Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper. Jeffrey Gray is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Skyjack is his first book. And Jeffrey Gray, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start with the myth, because you spend a good part of the book sort of breaking down this myth that has come to surround D.B. Cooper and surround the story. You say in the book that Cooper's crime transcended crime. What's the legend as you see it?
Well, I mean, when I first started, you know, researching this case, you know, one of the things that really struck me was that the story of D.B. Cooper really sent, you know, our own ideas about crime into a tailspin, if you will. Mm. You know, most of us think as criminals as the bad guys, and the guys who catch them, the cops, the FBI agents, law enforcement, as the good guys.
Right.
But what happened after Cooper's jump was that, in a way, the opposite happened. You know, one of the things I found was that even on these hunts, even on these searches through this rugged wilderness in the mud, in the snow, in the muck, these law enforcement, these sheriffs, these deputies were all looking for this guy, but they actually didn't want to find them, or at least some of them did. You know, one of the sheriffs said, you know, you can't help but admire the guy.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think what's unique about Cooper, and I don't know if he planned this or not, and I actually think that he didn't, you know, but, you know, Cooper was able to, through one jump,
right,
just by falling out of a plane, create this scenario where the good guys were rooting for the bad guys to get away. And I think that's interesting. And I think that one of the reasons why the case has lasted so long is not because we still don't know definitively who Cooper was, but because his story and his crime is about something more.
Yeah.
It allows us to really sort of assess why we root for heroes and why some of them stick and some of them don't.
A good part of this, it seems, a key, I guess, to understanding it, that question is the context of time. This was the fall of 1971. As you put it in the book, it was a nation at war with itself. And it's kind of extraordinary. I hadn't realized what was – you mentioned Nixon being the center of kind of the sense of mistrust and paranoia that's going on in the country. There's all these strange things happening. A big earthquake happens that year. Of course, there's Vietnam, but the strange weather, urban violence. I mean, something is in the air.
Indeed, and money. You know, I mean, of all these things, you know, unfortunately, one of the things that really sort of governs, you know, our country and our communities is money. And when people have it, times are good. And when people don't, times are crazy. And in this moment, you know, in the fall of 1971, the country was mired in recession. And even airlines were struggling to survive. People were hard out. And so when people are hard out, when there's a sense of chaos, that leaves this window open, this vacuum in a way, for people to sort of seize control and impose their own boundaries of morality, of good and bad. And in that vacuum, Cooper landed.
One thing I didn't understand was that, as I mentioned in the introduction, there were all kinds of skyjackings going on during the era. I mean, you call it a national epidemic.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, one of the facts that, like, you know, it still blows me away is that in the fall of 1971, there was one airplane hijacked around the world once a week. Hmm. You know, I mean, hijackings were so common that even, you know, I'm in Miami right now, and one of the things that they did here in the 70s was to an idea that they had was to build a replica of the Havana airport outside of Miami. So when hijackers would hijack planes and say, hey, take me to Cuba, the pilots would just do a big loop,
yeah,
and try to land at this fake Havana airport. Now, they didn't go through with that plan, but the fact that they thought about it suggests really how crazy skyjackings were. And, you know, in addition to just the fear of being taken someplace you don't want to go in an airplane, people were scared to fly.
Right.
You know, flying, you know, humans, we have 2 feet. We're supposed to stay on the ground, and gravity keeps us down here. You know, the jumbo jet really defied sort of our own imaginations of what could be done, and it also shrank the world. You know, one of the things that happened the year before the hijacking was that the 747 rolled out of the Boeing hangar.
Right.
And the jumbo jet, this idea that we, you know, so many people could be in to go from one place to other, to be in Shanghai, China, from Seattle, and then go from Shanghai to Seoul, and you know, it shrunk the world. And I think that created a lot of anxiety amongst a lot of people. I mean, just over the future.
Yeah, you also explore. I thought this was really interesting in the book. There's this part where you kind of. There's a little kind of a do a little psychoanalyzing, I guess, of the skyjacker, or the motif anyway of the skyjacker. And you write that the skyjacker himself was a kind of schizotranscendentalist. And one psychiatrist you mentioned had described the experience of taking over a plane as this kind of holy experience. Talk about what you were getting at there.
Well, I mean, one of the great things about having, you know, the luxury of researching a story for 2 or 3 years is that you get to, you know, pour into every cranny and nook. Mm. And it's not only evidence you're sifting through. I mean, one of the things that I tried to do in trying to figure out who the hijacker was to understand the psychology of the hijacker. And a lot of the book is sort of told, or a lot of the investigation that I conducted was kind of through the eyes of, like, what I imagine a criminal profiler, or what criminal profilers do, which is they try to understand motive, right, and the psychology behind the motive. And if you were to read all the D.B. Cooper T-shirts and listen to the D.B. Cooper songs, and if you are fortunate enough to attend our D.B. Cooper symposium, you know, there's a lot of hero talk. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of pirate talk, a lot of Robin Hood of the Sky talk, this guy who was able to upend the big machine. And, you know, we're fascinated by that, especially in American culture. But the truth is, according to the psychologist reports that I studied of hijackers, and there were a lot of them done in the 70s, is that the hijackers were, in a lot of ways, not heroes. They were not courageous people. They were, by the by, you know, people who were at their wit's end, people who suffered severe depression, people who had, according to the psychologists, traces, some heavier than others, of paranoid schizophrenia. Mm. And when we think of somebody who takes over a plane with a bomb or claims that it's a bomb, you know, that's a big deal. You know, what that's saying, that expression is saying, I'm prepared to commit murder. and I'm prepared to commit suicide. And what a lot of early psychologists thought of was that this was, you know, this kind of a way for somebody who was willing to check out of life at the very end to commit, you know, one fine deed, one fine thing, to do one thing really well. And what's unique that a lot of psychologists found also was the hijacker's relationship to gravity.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when Freud was around doing his psychoanalysis, and by, listen, I don't pretend to be any expert or even close to that in psychology, but, you know, when Freud was doing his work, there wasn't mass travel in planes. And a lot of the psychologists really were just fascinated and wondered what would Freud say, or how is just the idea that we're breaking through gravity affecting, you know, our egos and our ids. You know, in a lot of ways, gravity, at least the psychologists that studied hijackers, compared gravity to the impossible father.
Right.
You know, it's this force that governs us all from birth. You know, we're pinned down literally from the moment we, you know, we start existing by gravity. And we can never break through with it except when we're on airplanes. You know, so all these kinds of weird kind of fantasies that people have on planes, a certain kind of giddiness and anxiety that comes with travel. You know, we're defying, in a way, the impossible father, gravity.
Mm. It's interesting, the legend that sort of develops around this Dan Cooper, this D.B. Cooper figure. A genteel, urbane, well-dressed, sophisticated fellow. I mean, that's the sort of the myth. That's the image. But you write about him as, and I think you've used this word, in fact, he was this kind of a schlub.
You know, absolutely. You know, and this is one of the, I mean, myth, you know, our myths, we create our myths. We need to have these myths. And in doing so, we sort of change the facts. And one of the things that I found in the FBI's files, which is, I mean, one of the cool things about this book and my investigation, is that I was able to get access to the, you know, official D.B. Cooper case files. And these are, you know, this is an open investigation. These are confidential files. And so for the first time, you know, you can read about what exactly happened, not necessarily what people are celebrating, what they think happened. And according to the myth, we have the genteel thief, you know.
Yeah.
The genteel thief is a character that we kind of make our criminal heroes out to be. But in fact, this guy wore a burgundy sport jacket.
Right.
He wore
it was
with
a
wide
piece
lapels.
Of junk. Yeah, yep.
He wore a clip-on tie from JCPenney's that had all kinds of stains all over it. You know, he was somebody who was very quick to put, I think, this plan together. You know, another thing people talk about is, oh, this guy must have been a master, you know, master criminal, master thief. But, you know, the facts actually, you know, lead to somebody. I'm thinking of somebody who's just, you know, out in their shop basement with a bunch of bolts and screws, you know, an expert at really sort of putting different pieces together in different parts. You know, somebody who was up to this challenge.
Yeah. And it just so happens that, of course, the clincher is that he got away with it, or at least his body hasn't been found. He hasn't been heard from. And that was the thing that sent him into this mythic stature, I suppose. That was the one thing. I mean, you know, aside from all the other stuff, he seemed to have gotten away with it.
Well, what's cool, or not what's cool about it, but, you know, what's underneath the seams here are I think two main character traits, right? One is that he was able to get away, but two, the crime itself required such a demonstration of raw courage.
Yeah.
You know, it just took real guts, and people, especially the agents and the searchers, were enamored by that. You know, people would say, you'd hear, you know, sheriffs say, well, you know, if he took, you know, but this guy had, if he had the guts to pull this off, by Lord, just let him have the money.
Right.
You know, and another thing that's going on too in the making of the myth of D.B. Cooper is the idea that whoever Cooper was a raw, rugged individualist, you know. This was an era when individualism in our country was becoming, you know, obsolete. This was an era of big corporation, of efficiency and economy. People who were used to sort of working for kind of mom and pop stores were kind of, you know, getting laid off, getting passed by younger, more efficient kind of workers. You know, I think, and especially on the assembly lines of some of these airline factories, people were really talking about that. So Cooper was, in a lot of ways, what made him the ultimate individualist is not necessarily his clip-on tie and his sartorial flair, but the fact that he was able to outdo these big systems, the airlines, the FBI, you know, all these big moving parts. And when they said that Cooper became or was likened to Robin Hood, the reason why a lot of sociologists liken him to Robin Hood is not because he robbed from the rich and gave to the poor, but it's that he was able to defy the big and complex, which is kind of a different variation of that situation, that complex.
We'll get into, when we get back from a break here in a moment, we'll get into how you came to the story. We'll start to break it down, some of the really fascinating characters and suspects that play into the story. But let me ask you this before we head into this break. Do you think you understand what it is that was so compelling for you, this story? Was it the mystery? Was it the complexity of the personality? Was it the sort of the temptation that you may solve this thing? Or I guess it was all of those things that sort of came together.
I mean, there was a lot of fruits, you know, a lot of fruits that I was chasing and a lot of flashes drawing me in different directions. I think that as an investigative reporter and just as me, you know, I can't help not knowing. You know, it's just that one itch, you know, that you can't scratch. I need to know. You know, I feel like I need to know, and I think that one of the things that I learned in sort of exploring what was propelling me forward is, well, why do I need to know? You know, and I think that the reason why is that our culture now, we know everything, right. And it's so easy for us to know everything. You know, you can have a conversation with somebody, and you know they could break halfway through and say, oh, well, let me just find out what it is that we want to know. Conversation over. You know, we've become so accustomed to having the truth at our fingertips and just a web search away, that the idea that there was still somebody out there who'd pulled off such a thing, and then, you know, the way we're so monitored now and so, you know, that just mystified and fascinated by how this one person, whoever he was, could have managed to slip away.
Jeffrey Gray is with us. He's a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper is the name of the book. It's his first. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West at KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the story of D.B. Cooper. For more than 40 years now, the hijacking in the skies above the Pacific Northwest has remained a crime unsolved. The hijacker, who has come to be known as D.B. Cooper, there was one of the most extensive manhunts of the 20th century, and he's become an outlaw, a legend. The investigative journalist Jeffrey Gray has written a book that dissects the story. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about it. His book is called Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper. Jeffrey Gray, why don't you talk, if you would, about – explain how you became interested in the story. I mean, as I understand it, it sort of comes during this conversation with this really interesting private investigator.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, one of the things that that I've learned over the years is that to find a really great story, you just can't do it, you know. They have to find you. The great stories actually have to find you. And so what that means is you have to, at least from the reporting end, you know, you have to kind of try to put yourself in a position to have great stories find you. Yeah. And the way to do that is just to be friends with interesting people. And, you know, a good friend and source of mine for years has been Skip Porteous, who ran a company called Sherlock Investigations. Right. Skip was a private eye. But unlike a lot of private eyes, he didn't, you know, cut his teeth in law enforcement. He was actually a preacher back in the day. And, you know, he called me this one afternoon and he told me, you know, I got this great story for you. And, you know, I remember I was so hungry. You know, I just hadn't had lunch, and I was just wasn't even thinking. I was like, all right, whatever it is, let's just meet for lunch. Where are you? Here am I. We met in the middle. And he told me about this story and how it had come to him. And, you know, Skip is a Manhattan PI, you know, and he charges Manhattan prices.
Yeah.
And he had a very, you know, unique client who approached him, which was this guy named Lyle Christensen. And Lyle Christensen was the last person in the continental United States you think would hire a Manhattan PI. He lived in the middle of nowhere in Minnesota. He'd been retired from the Postal Service and was trying to reinvent himself in his 80s as an inventor.
Yeah.
But Lyle Christensen was convinced of one thing, and, you know, after you know, some very unique things had happened to him, he was 100% certain that his older brother, Kenny, was D.B. Cooper.
Right.
And I, at the time, actually had no idea about the case. I mean, I was born way after it happened. You know, I had no idea that anybody could have hijacked an airplane and done something like this.
Right.
And when I looked into his older brother, Kenny, there was just an unbelievable amount of detail and evidence to suggest that they're one and the same.
Yeah. And you're getting really excited. Like,
I looked at the photo of older brother Kenny, and I looked at the composite sketch of Dan / DB Cooper,
yeah,
and I thought, oh my God, you know, this is the one.
Hmm.
And what was so, you know, and then I dug further, and what I found was old Army records. Turns out older brother Kenny was in the paratroops.
Yeah.
Wow. Must have known how to use a parachute. It turns out he lived in the nearby area, so he would have known, you know, the woods and how to get along. He had taken survival training. He was, you know, there's endless amounts, one thing after the other, about older brother Kenny and this mysterious life that he was living. And I was entranced, you know, just to go back to your other question about, you know, what was so interesting to you about this or what drove you. Yeah, it's the unknown and the unsolved mystery pushing you forward, but at the same time, it's the unsolved mysteries within normal people.
Yeah.
You know, I'm interested in people and the riches of normal life. And so, you know,
I have to say that's what's striking about the book. Not just that it works toward some revelation of a great mystery, or that you're working through some great mystery, but the characters in here, Kenny among them, and you explore them. You explore their personal lives, who they are, their relationships. In many ways, that's what the book's about, almost as much as the mystery itself.
Absolutely, because there's all that one side of us that others are trying to figure out, and there are these. I mean, I there's some of the great moments that I had, you know, reporting and writing the book, were the day that Lyle sent me a copy of Kenny's letters that he sent back home from the war. And, you know, Kenny was stationed way out in Japan in the small town. And to open up the mail and to read Kenny's letter as Lyle and his family was reading it around their dinner table in their barn that they lived in the middle of Minnesota was thrilling. You know, I mean, this is treasure, you know, absolute treasure. And it's just a letter. It's just, you know, Kenny was not even, you know, Kenny was the mail clerk on his base.
Yeah.
But it was incredibly rich and incredibly moving to listen to Kenny write to his family about donning these primitive parachutes and jumping out of planes for money just as practice or as for drills. And then, you know, in one of the letters he said, you know, jumping out of one of these planes, I felt like a million in spending his check, I felt like a millionaire counting his millions, you know.
Mm.
And all these details and the memories of Lyle and his brother and his search, Lyle's search for D.B. Cooper was in a lot of ways, I found, you know, a way for that he could keep his brother alive. And there, the other suspects in the case have similar motives and also offer treasure in plain sight, you know, in plain sight.
They're projecting. They're projecting fears, as you say in the book. They're projecting their own, as you say, love and affection for their loved ones that they think are connected to it. They're projecting it on that story, I guess.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, a real dogged Cooper sleuth who's probably been working in the case the hardest over the last 15 years is a woman by the name of Jo Weber, and she lives in Florida.
Yeah.
And After her husband Dwayne died, she went through his belongings and found a wallet where he had fake identification under a totally different name.
Right.
Okay. And I've seen the wallet. It's true. And why would anybody in their, you know, in their late 70s have fake ID? And when she began to investigate this fake alias, she found out that the man that she'd been married to for 17 years was a professional criminal and had spent time in at least 5 federal penitentiaries before she met him. And, you know, to have that, to make that kind of discovery, you know.
Yeah. Well, and he has, like Lyle, whose brother on his deathbed has something he wants to say, a similar kind of thing happens to Joe and Dwayne. And she doesn't pay much attention to it, but he actually comes out and tells her.
Right.
He's D.B. Cooper.
Right. Or not D.B., but Dan.
Dan, right, right. Yeah, yeah. Which is even better because it's D.B. is not – it was Dan Cooper, the name of the
– Right. And one just – you know, interesting aside on the nuts and bolts of the FBI investigation is that the reason why D.B. Cooper is D.B. Cooper is because the FBI wanted it to be that way. You know, once the mess up with the name was erroneously reported in the next day's newspaper, the FBI sent out word to their branches, don't change the fact that it's Dan Cooper, because so many clues and tips were coming in about a D.B. Cooper,
yeah.
People who are alleging to be D.B., that the FBI thought that if they could keep that one fact that they actually knew that the guy's name or alias was Dan Cooper,
right,
they could weed out suspects.
So you're planning your Pulitzer Prize, you say in the book. You figured this, it wasn't Dwayne that you at least keyed on at first. It was Kenny Christensen, and then you meet.
You know that letter, by the way, hasn't come in yet.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. From the Pulitzer Committee.
You know, well, you never know.
Keep checking the mail.
So this is August of 2007, and you're seeing all these characteristics that Kenny has. He's a military man. He knew airplanes. He, you know, he resembled the sketch. He was a paratrooper, as you say, a chain smoker, smoked cheap cigarettes like this Dan Cooper fellow did. It's about the same age. So he had it all kind of figured out. And then you go to Ralph Himmelsbach. He's a retired special agent who had worked on the case. I mean, he's kind of the voice of reason, I think you say, the voice of reason in all of this case. And you make your presentation to him and talk about what happens there. He kind of deflates you.
Well, I mean, H, you know, as Himmelsbach's called in Cooperland, I was convinced was going to greenlight and give me his kosher stamp of approval on Kenny. And I, you know, I could see us both there almost on the Pulitzer podium committee, you know?
Yeah.
but it turns out that unlike me at the time, you know, Himmelsbach had already vetted, you know, hundreds and hundreds of suspects. And so what's he say? Well, you know, he's a little too short. He's got the wrong color eyes and he weighs too much. And I drove away from his forum just wanted to cry, just pull over and cry. What am I doing here? But, you know, the more I thought about it and the more people I eventually interviewed, you know, the details, especially as reported by eyewitnesses during, you know, a chaotic moment, are often off. You know, there has to be a certain degree of error. You know, Kenny's eyes, as reported on his driver's license, were hazel. Kenny's eyes reported by the stewardess in the brief time she saw them in the back of the plane were brown.
Yeah.
Well, okay, on a plane when you're getting hijacked, who can tell the difference between brown and hazel? So I scratched that one off the list. And then I found myself kind of doing though, you know, because I was so into Kenny, I found myself doing, you know, something that you know, I was looking for ways to make Kenny work.
Yeah.
You know, I was sort of, you know, stretching the boundaries of my own kind of imagination and not necessarily looking for ways to rule out. And one of the things that I found, especially in going through the FBI files, was that there are more Kenny Christensens, you know, and that there are other suspects out there who had the same coincidental, nearly identical matchups,
yeah,
that he did. And then I thought, oh, I got a real problem here.
Yeah.
You know, because I actually at one point thought, well, I actually believe that 4 people are the hijacker. I thought they all had done it.
Right.
Or I could see why they had all had done it. And I thought, I sat back and I was like, you know, this is the story actually about it. I mean, I'm not going to go try out and prove and claim that one person's the one. You know, if you don't have conclusive proof and there's some genetic, there's some biological DNA-like problems in this case. So the truth is that we might never know conclusively who Cooper was.
Right.
So if I couldn't prove that, you know, and lock it down on a DNA level or some other kind of level where it was inconclusive, I thought, well, you know, and I thought, well, follow what's interesting to you. And what's interesting to me was these personal hunts. And I thought that, you know, readers are smart. I'll let them decide who they want to believe in as suspects and try to be as true as I can to the storylines of the different characters.
And that's what you do. I mean, we go through and we'll talk about as many of these characters as we can with the time we have left. But, you know, you make the presentation and we'll go through it and we decide. But what's nice is you haven't really settled on one. You're leaving that up to us. I mean, you wanted it to be Kenny, at least at first, but I guess that was the thing you learned, is that it's a better story if you leave it up to the reader, I guess.
Well, or it's a different story.
Right.
You know, and, you know, to me, the treasure here, the lost ransom, if you will, of D.B. Cooper, was not actually locating the money, although there is a safety deposit box potentially in French Canada that I think the money is in right now. But, you know, that's another story.
Yeah.
You know, the real treasure to me are in these moments that exist between people. You know, when Lyle Christensen tells me that he has this one, of course that Kenny could be the parachutist because when they were younger, they played this game together where with their paw in their ranch, and their pa would tell them to get up on a board, and you know, he and his older brother would lift up the board, and then they would say jump, and Lyle would never jump, but Kenny always jumped. Kenny always did. You know, all these snapshots and these portraits of our life and how we live as families and people, I think to me were the real treasure and the gold.
Jeffrey, I wanted to ask about. Well, because he has a connection to Utah, let's talk about Richard McCoy. Really interesting figure. Had a Mormon family, so he goes to Vietnam. He's born in North Carolina, moves to Utah, enrolls at Brigham Young University, majors in criminal studies. Really an interesting fellow, and he's one of the people that are sort of he does this thesis about the skyjacker in school. Really complicated stuff, and you mentioned some of the questions about gravity and those kinds of things. Talk about Richard McCoy. He's another one of these really great characters.
Well, I mean, what made Richard Floyd McCoy Jr., you know, such a popular suspect is that 5 months after the Cooper hijacking, he managed to hijack another airplane.
Yeah.
Same Boeing 727, and you know, dropped the rear stairs and jumped out with $500,000 in cash. He trumped D.B. Cooper. And the similarities in which the crimes were sort of committed, the same kind of method that McCoy had used, led a lot of FBI agents to really believe that McCoy was Cooper. And that, you know, all kinds of theories speculated that, you know, maybe Cooper lost all the money in his jump. And so McCoy tried to do it again, sort of over near his hometown in Utah.
Yeah.
So his ability to pull the thing off led a lot of FBI agents at the time to really suspect him, and he really got a good look. And some FBI agents believe that McCoy was Cooper, and some don't. And he, you know, there's a certain kind of, McCoy has some followers and some fans of Cooper sleuths. And he's, you know, yet another. Well, I think what's interesting about how McCoy fits into the national kind of conversation or the national epidemic of hijackings that he was an all-American.
Yeah.
All-American boy. I mean, he had the Purple Hearts. He was decorated. You know, he was a decorated soldier and really wanted to become a lawman and flipped. You know, he had, for whatever reason, you know, had some desire to commit this hijacking.
I wonder if you there was another revelation. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that. Another lead. I mean, I guess these things. What do you think? They pop up every so often, every few years, and they all go about as far as you can go. But nothing is ever, at least yet, has been terribly conclusive. You always hit. There's always a dead end. I don't know if this is the reference to the Cooper's curse.
Right, which is all true.
Which is all as you can attest to. But talk about that if you would.
Well, I mean, you know, in the beginning of the program, you mentioned that the FBI's file in the Cooper case is 40 feet long.
Yeah.
It's true. I've seen it. But what's in there is not all case files. In fact, case files, you know, make up a small percentage of the file. The FBI file on D.B. Cooper is a depository of paranoia, if you will. I mean, it is a wonderful collection of letters written from people all over the country claiming that their brothers, nieces, neighbors, coworkers, bosses were the hijacker. Mm-hmm. So, you know, really what's going on every once in a while is when the Cooper case pops up, people see that sketch, you know, that sketch that could look like anybody. The sketch that everyone attributed, that said, oh, it looks like Bing Crosby.
Right.
You know, in the space in the sketch, in the blank whiteness, people paint in who they want Cooper to be. And so what you find every once in a while are people who develop their own suspects and try to come forward. So we had, a recent suspect come forward, and the FBI was investigating it and looking into it pretty good. And, yeah, the news got out about it. And
When your book was released. It was weird timing, actually, I thought. Didn't you?
Well, you know, it's funny. One of the I will confess that one big sweat of writing a book, especially about an unsolved crime, is that you always think that a week before the book's going to come out, someone's going to come forward and solve it.
Right, right.
And then you think, oh, you know, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
And literally a week before the pub date, you know, I was like trying to think of who, you know, I was considering, you know, trying to have a little book party and who I was going to invite. And I look on the news and it says D.B. Cooper case solved.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a big sweat, but it was a very actually interesting development, because what I found to be similar in the suspect that was being brought forward was similarities to all the different suspects before. And it was really this testament that the Cooper case was in this sort of cyclical turn. You know, Mark Twain had this great quote, and he said, you know, history never repeats itself. It only rhymes.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what goes on in D.B. Cooper land. Every so often, you know, new suspects come forward. People have memories. People have photos. People here have family stories. And they're all kind of vetted and analyzed. And, you know, another reason why nothing ever comes up, though, is that the FBI, who is the official law enforcement body investigating this case, you know, they never claim anybody is Cooper, and they never claim that anybody isn't.
Right.
So because they're not ruling out suspects, and they don't necessarily have the kind of evidence that they can rule out or rule in, everybody's in until they're not.
Yeah.
And that's kind of created, especially in the D.B. Cooper community, this tremendously weird vibe and environment where people are constantly vetting each other's suspects.
Hmm. Do you want this mystery to be solved?
There are those who are comfortable with a mystery.
Yeah.
And they are content to be titillated with the unknown. And it's enough for some to extract whatever meaning they can out of a crime or a story and continue on with their daily life. I'm not one of those people. I'm a reporter. I like to hunt stuff out. I like uncovering stuff. And I like the big cases. And I like working these things. And I still very much want this case to be solved. I want to know who it is. I want to be able to know who it is definitively.
Yeah.
I want to see that day, and I want to, I'm still working on it. I mean,
no, I know. I do figure in the next 5 years, we'll know.
Well, let's talk specifics for a second.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's just talk specifics there. In order for this case, in my opinion, to really be solved, we need some biological DNA match.
Right.
you know, this is the culture we live in. DNA and science, it's so prevalent in criminal investigations. I think that the only way that folks will accept a match on the hijacker is through DNA.
Right.
Now, the problem is that the samples that the FBI has to test are weak. There is some saliva that was found, traces of saliva on the hijacker's tie, but it come from three different people.
Yeah.
So nobody knows who it's from, and the code, the DNA code on that saliva isn't good enough, I'm told, to actually make a definitive match. The fingerprints, there are some, but they were found on the in-flight magazine in front of the hijacker's seat. Now, you've been on an airplane, and so have I, and
yeah.
So have a lot of other people, and everybody's flipping through that magazine. So how can we tell, really, if the fingerprints are going to match? So that's sort of a long shot, in my opinion.
Yeah.
The key to the case, I really believe this, is the 8 Raleigh filter tip cigarette butts that Cooper smoked and that were found by the FBI on that night in the ashtray on his seat.
Right.
These cigarette butts were collected as evidence. They were then sent to the FBI lab, the files and reports show, in Quantico, Virginia. They were then sent back with the rest of the evidence to the FBI's field office in Las Vegas. Now, there, the story ends. You know, nobody knows where these actual cigarette butts are.
Yeah.
When the former case agent, Larry Carr, requested the physical evidence to be retested in 2007, he got the tie back and he got the in-flight magazine, but he didn't get the cigarette butts. So somewhere the cigarette butts are between the Las Vegas office and who knows where.
Right.
And if we could get those cigarette butts, then we could use the saliva embedded in the cotton fibers to potentially extract a DNA code. And then we could run that DNA code through all the different libraries in the country. But we need those cigarette butts because without those, we don't have a code. And without the code, it's going to be hard to crack the case.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you.
Thanks. And if you see the cigarette butts, let me know.
I will. Jeffrey Gray, contributing editor at New York Magazine. His book is called Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper. He joined us from member station WLRN in Miami. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lynn Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.